Good morning. My name is Patrick Keeley, and I represent the Appellant Research Automation. I'd like to start today with why we believe that this appeal has important issues. The first one is, even though it's a procedural venue issue that is not as substantive in many of the cases, that we believe that if we're going through the history of the cases, as I will and have in the brief, that there's been a lack of clarity with respect to how you deal with the standards when you're dealing with two or three of the issues, first to file, the 1404 analysis or a Rule 13 compulsory counterclaim. Second, when we have a smaller case like this where we're involving cases under $1 million, $500,000 at issue, litigating in a foreign forum is a hardship, perhaps, on the litigants.
Well, on somebody.
On somebody. And therefore, it's important. In this case, we're dealing with the first-to-file doctrine as well as the 1404 doctrine. And in the history of the cases, going back to 1939, in the Milwaukee case and in 59, the Graybar case, the courts have come up with the first-to-file doctrine, and initially it was a pretty strict rule of the first-to-file wins because we're not going to have two cases pending at the same time that could result in two different results. The doctrine was not an equitable one or a statutory one, but one that was brought about by comity as well as the inherent powers of the court. As the cases developed, particularly when we get into the later years of Graybar, the courts recognized that it shouldn't be a fixed standard, but there are certain exceptions to the first-to-file rule, and I call those the standard exceptions: the inability to obtain jurisdiction, the race to the courthouse, bad faith filing, and that the second action may have progressed further than the first. When we get to the mid-90s and we get to the Aplexian case and this court's ruling in the asset allocation case, into the history of the standards creeps the exception of balance of inconvenience. But in those two cases, and in many of the cases, although the court recognizes the second set of exceptions, imbalance of inconvenience, they really deal with the traditional standards or the traditional exceptions of inability to obtain jurisdiction or the trivial nature of the case, the declaratory nature of the case, and perhaps the race to the courthouse. Later on in the cases, we do deal with the 1404 analysis. There are many cases, and those cited by the defendant in this case, that deal with the 1404 analysis. And in those cases, what we generally find, even though the courts are using the traditional 1404 analysis, they generally find for the first to file anyway, or there is a substantial reason to transfer under 1404. And there's a good reason for this. And this is the crux of the problem, the crux of this case. If the court were to analyze the cases under both analyses separately, the 1404 analysis would swallow the first rule. That is,
you've developed that argument in your brief, Mr. Keeley, and I get my question is, what's wrong with that? In other words, why does the fact that a second case was filed, why should that affect the 1404 A analysis for a district judge in Chicago deciding whether to keep the case or transfer it somewhere else?
For two reasons. Number one, one of the analysis, because in every first-to-file case, there can be a 1404
right.
issue. And if there is a presumption, a strong presumption, as the first-to-file cases have held and have strongly held, then the 1404 analysis loses that presumption. And in this case, that's exactly what happened.
Under your theory, then, somebody in the defendant's situation weakens its position with respect to venue by filing the second case.
Exactly.
Why is that? And
exactly.
Why does that make sense?
That was addressed in the Citicorp case, the New York circuit case. And in that case, the court held at the end of the case is that because the economy of justice of filing the second case, just going down the street and ignoring the fact that there's a first case here where you could simply come in and file a motion to transfer, but you chose to go down the street, file a second case, make the plaintiff defend there. For those reasons, you now have to deal with both, and there's a way to reconcile them. And in fact, the Barrington case.
So we ought to punish the defendant for filing the second case rather than just relying on 1404A analysis?
Not necessarily. I don't believe that it's a punishment. It's a tactical decision. For some reason, the defendant.
Well, it sounds like punishment. If we say, well, we're going to change the 1404A analysis and give you more weight to the first to file.
And the recent cases of the inefficiency. And the recent cases of Warshawski, Barrington, and Citigroup case all come to that conclusion. In order to have the first rule have any, the motion to enjoin under the first rule, for it to have any effect, you must do the analyses together. In fact, there was some question here as to would these motions be heard simultaneously or one after the other. And the court did hear them simultaneously, and I think that is the appropriate way to do the analysis, because if you don't, you can't reconcile them. That is to say that under the Warshawski case, Citigroup case, and the Barrington case, the court came to the conclusion that there is a higher standard and uses different words, by the way. In the traditional 1404 analysis, the word is the movement must clearly make the case. In the other cases, it's substantially, strongly, and they use a heightened standard. In the Barrington case, even goes as far to say that if this were just a 1404 analysis and there wasn't a first case filed, the result may have been different. Recognizing the point directly on point that
Mr.
when you
Keeley, let me ask you from these photographs, I can't really tell just how big is the machine that we're talking about here?
Relatively large.
That's not very helpful.
About the size of this bench and outwards.
Would it fit in a tractor trailer?
It's assembled and disassembled, and it does fit in a tractor trailer.
In one? Okay.
Yes.
So how much does it cost to ship back and forth with the assembly and disassembly?
The shipment itself is about $10,000.
Okay. And then there's a lot of work that goes into preparing it.
There's
disassembly and reassembly, right?
There is some assembly work and disassembly. I don't have the exact cost to do that.
Right now the machine's in Virginia, right?
Which we claim is a problem. And the problem is because according to the Second Amendment, if the payment wasn't made and there was a claim that the machine didn't function, even though they acknowledged that it did function when it left Illinois, the agreement provided that it would be returned. And
okay.
To the extent that that's a basis for deciding in Virginia on a 1404 analysis, we think that that's just unfair. Okay, the machine should be here. And it should be under contract, and they shouldn't be given.
But the contract was to produce a machine that would actually work in Virginia, right?
The contract was to produce a machine that would work. It also provided that it would be delivered to Virginia, and that gets to the error part of.
But your guys were responsible for making sure that it would work in Virginia, right?
We were responsible to make sure that it worked, that it was delivered to Virginia and set up in Virginia, and that it would work. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think what the court's going to is if we're just looking at a straight 1404 analysis, the court, in our belief, did even err on a straight 1404 analysis. I understand the standard is different because we don't have the presumption of the first to file. I'm not quarreling with the ruling with respect to how she balances the various factors in 1404, but if you read the opinion, It's clear that everything is pretty much balanced in the district court's ruling, that everything is about a draw until we come down to performance. And in performance, the district court focuses upon the fact that performance is completed in Virginia, the delivery, as Your Honor has pointed out here. What is ignored is that the vast majority of the performance took place in Illinois. The 2 years of design, construction, testing all took place in Illinois. The simple delivery, and in fact, the acceptance was in Illinois under the acknowledgement that is at issue here. But if you take the performance, and its final performance was in Virginia, what is ignored is even under a 14-4 analysis, there is high deference given to the plaintiff's forum state, and that wasn't given here. And under the first to file analysis, there's a presumption. And if you look at
this isn't really a case of a pure first to file application because of the chronology here and the litigation history among the parties. The defendant SBI really was first to file in this dispute, but there were lengthy and ongoing negotiations over a fix for the problem that eventually led to a non-suit in that case. And so it's not really even a pure application of the first-to-file rule, because SBI was the first-to-file, ended up dismissing the case as these negotiations were ongoing, and then you filed here. And so it's really, you know, first-to-file, second-to-file, third-to-file.
That's what the SBI's position is, and I understand what Your Honor is saying, but clearly the court, the district court, found that Research unquestionably filed the first case. In other words, at the time of the filing, there was no case pending, and the fact that the state court case that had been on file for many years and had been dismissed because it was not prosecuted was not a factor and is not a factor to be considered. I don't think there is any position that there was any case on file and that the first-to-file doctrine does apply, because it was, in fact, the first-to-file of the cases that are pending, the two cases that are of substantively filed. And I see my time is becoming limited, and I wanted to, again, draw the court's attention to the issue. And the issue here is, if we have these three standards, different standards, Rule 13, first to file, and 1404, they do have to be looked at together, particularly when there is two substantive cases. It's not like we filed a deck action or it was an insubstantive action. We have two substantive cases that are terribly identical, and in those cases, it doesn't make logical sense. And the courts have recognized that in recent years, to just ignore the first analysis and go simply to the second, and ignore the presumption that is there. And in fact, the court specifically found that there were none of the traditional exceptions here. There was some discussion about whether there was a race to the courthouse, but the court specifically found out, making no finding in that regard. The Schwartz case and the Warshawski case say that if there isn't a finding on the record and there's no evidence of record on the record with respect to those exceptions, the traditional exceptions, the first-to-file presumption prevails. Now, and if you look at the 1404 cases in this context, there are very few, and the only one that comes to mind is the Aguilar case, where the 1404 prevailed over the first-to-file. And in that case, the factors were so substantial that the level had risen so high that the court allowed the case to be transferred to Puerto Rico, where the remedy, the contract, the damages, and where the corporation that was being formed rested.
Mr. Keeley, have you all been doing discovery?
We have not.
Why not? You're going to have to do the same discovery no matter where it's pending, right?
That's right.
So
the discovery was stayed in the Virginia case.
Presumably at the party's request? While this appeal gets resolved?
It was done. It was stayed early on in the Virginia case. There was a stay of discovery. To be honest with you, I can't understand whether it was pursuant to the court's request or our request.
I mean,
have we proceeded with our internal investigation and our experts? Yes, we have. Has formal discovery been instituted? The answer is no.
And there's nothing been done, I guess, to try to remedy this thing, make the thing work.
We've asked to go down there and convince them that we can put it together and make it work. We haven't gotten any that far in the discussions.
You describe this as a relatively small case.
Well, it's not a billion dollar case, and I think litigants in smaller cases should have the ability to choose their forum. I think everybody understands the inconvenience. I'm just saying that to litigate in a foreign jurisdiction in a smaller case has a higher impact relative to what's at stake. I think that's a practical consideration.
So do appeals. Since ordinarily these kinds of decisions under 1404A aren't even appealed.
They are not, and in fact our appeal was denied preliminarily, and the court on rehearing allowed us to bring this appeal because of the injunctive nature and the first to file aspect of the case. And I understand that the reasons why 1404 aren't usually wasting your time. But I think in this case, if you look at the history of the cases as we've developed, this court could take the opportunity to clarify how the circuit court, how the district courts and the litigants are to balance these two analyses and how you justify them. And I think if we follow the Warsawski, the Citigroup, and the Barrington cases, that makes the logical way of handling both at the same time all work together. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Mr. Lifson?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Roman Lifson, and I represent the appellee, Schrader Bridgeport. Your Honor, in this case, there are several key principles that are involved. Number one, the district court, after following an exhaustive and complete analysis of transfer under Rule 1404, decided that transfer was unavoidable. And it did not decide that it was a close call, but it decided that transfer was unavoidable. The second principle, and the court already has touched on this morning, is that the Section 1404 factors apply whether there's one case or two. The Section 1404 factors apply if there is a motion to transfer under Section 1404, which in some cases there is, like in this case, and in other cases there's not. Also, contrary to the appellant's suggestion, the district court specifically addressed the first-to-file rule. It did not ignore it. And the district court also found that the appellant's actions in this case are, in the district court's words, troubling for two reasons. Now, REI's fundamental argument, as I think the court already has recognized, just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because the argument is that as soon as you have a second case that's filed, Section 1404 goes out the window, and district court shouldn't even consider those factors. Now, let's imagine if SBI did not file its second case in Virginia. SBI still would have been able to and would have filed a motion to transfer under Section 1404 in the district court in Illinois, and the district court would have gone through the same analysis that it went through and presumably reached the same decision. The fact that there are two cases present doesn't mean that Section 1404 no longer matters. And as I mentioned, we have cases in which Section 1404 motions simply are not filed. They're not filed for a variety of reasons, mostly because the litigants probably believe there's not a sufficient basis to make a 1404 motion, or for whatever tactical reason. And interestingly, the cases that Mr. Keeley discussed with you this morning, such as Graybar, Aplexion, asset allocation, those are all cases in which there is not even a Section 1404 motion filed. However, interestingly, in all those cases, the courts, in dealing with the first-to-file rule, still say, but the first-to-file rule, not only is it not applied rigidly and mechanically, but it can be overcome by unusual circumstances or a balance of convenience. So even in those cases, the courts still pay attention to the judicial economy and the balance of convenience. But certainly when we have cases where Section 1404 motion to transfer is filed, there hasn't been a single court which has said, we're going to ignore that. And in fact, I take issue with Mr. Keeley's argument that there's a lack of clarity in the law here. In fact, the law is abundantly clear, and the law is really clear in the cases that REI itself cites. And I could be here for the rest of the day with this, but I'll give you just one example. On page 18 of REI's brief, REI claims, quote, the factors related to a Section 1404A transfer venue are not generally part of a proper analysis in a first-to-file case. That's the argument. If you look on the same page, 3 inches above, REI cites the Emergency Care Research Institute versus Guyden case. That was a case very similar to this one. Plaintiff filed first in Pennsylvania, defendant filed second in Minnesota. Two motions were pending in Pennsylvania, one by plaintiff to enjoin the Minnesota suit and a motion by the defendant to transfer under Section 1404. So what does the court do? The court says, and I quote, we will first address defendant's motion to transfer pursuant to Section 1404A. In that case, the court decided there were not sufficient grounds to transfer the case under 1404, so only then did the court go to the first-to-file rule. Barrington was mentioned this morning. Barrington, again, recognizes that a sufficient imbalance of convenience can tip the scales. But interestingly, Barrington cites Annette Holdings. And Annette Holdings The court, in the Northern District of Illinois case, the court held the equitable factors to be considered in determining whether to find an exception to the first-to-file rule track those considered in ruling on a motion to transfer under 1404. So these are not, 1404 doesn't all of a sudden disappear. Now, REI, in its reply brief, I think it recognizes that we can't just completely get rid of Section 1404. So what REI argues is that this court should create out of whole cloth a new three-part test which places a higher burden in cases where there is a second case. And there's simply no support for this argument. There's no higher burden that's ever been applied in this circumstance by any court. And simply the Section 1404 analysis is followed. And in this particular case, the district court simply got it right. And again, as the previous case mentioned, the standard of review is one for abuse of discretion. And the question is, did Judge Gottschalk act arbitrarily?
Let me ask you the same question I asked earlier. Given the deferential standard here, given the balance of inconvenience, in essence, depending on whether it's who gets to litigate at home, given that we've got some performance in both states, some non-party witnesses who presumably might be in both states, would it have been an abuse of discretion to keep the case here?
Well, Your Honor, I think I'm going to give you the same answer that my colleague in the case before.
You're saying you don't have to answer me.
No. I will answer you. And my
he
answer
didn't
is,
answer me.
Well, Your Honor, my answer is we may not have appealed it, but the district court found only one factor that favors keeping the case in Illinois, and that is the fact that REI chose the forum. As the court already recognized this morning, in this particular case, that is of dubious value because it wasn't the first case to file. And REI filed, and the reason they filed as quickly as they did, and the reason they filed before even our performance was required, and why the district court found that action was, quote, troubling, is because they knew that we'd already chosen Virginia as the forum. They already knew that this case had been filed in Virginia. They already knew that if this contractual problem could not be resolved, as we've been trying to resolve it for years, that SBI would pursue the case in Virginia. And that's why they ran to the courthouse and filed it as still the testing was being completed. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, I think there would have been a good case for an abuse of discretion argument if the district court had decided to not transfer the case.
Let me ask you, are the parts that we're talking about here that you guys make, are they what are called trader valves? Is that the?
They're three families of parts. They're all little valves that are used in wheel automotive
like
wheels.
Tires.
Wheels and tires, exactly.
Okay. The trader valves.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
And that's why those parts' integrity is so important because we sell those to automotive manufacturers who rely on those parts to function so we don't have things like tires blown out and on cars as they're traveling down the highway. So the district court found one factor in favor of REI, but it found two very important factors favoring transfer. Number one, that the place of material events certainly occurred in Virginia. The location of evidence, where the machine is, the district court said, well, that slightly favors Virginia. That didn't sound like that was a decisive factor. But the third factor that the district court found strongly favored transfer to Virginia is the fact that the time to trial in Virginia is much faster, a difference of 10 months. And that's certainly one of the factors that's used in the 1404 analysis. The place of material events, I don't see a strong argument by REI that the district court got that wrong because, sure, there were negotiations back and forth. People from each company were visiting the other. But as Your Honor noted, the whole point of the contract was to have this machine in place in SBI's facility in Alta Vista, Virginia, and function. And when originally the reason why we're so far down the line and so much time has passed is because we gave REI every chance in the world to make this thing work. It's not in our interest to have this large machine sitting on our assembly floor, taking up space, not working and doing nothing. That's not something that we wanted. And originally, when we filed our case, it was the first case, it was already more than a year after the deadline had passed for REI to deliver to the machine. But we decided to work with REI to see if this whole project could be solved, which led to us not serving the lawsuit, which led us to the amendment that's involved in the case. And unfortunately, we are here with the machine that
apparently worked okay in Illinois, but not in Virginia.
Well, and Your Honor, that is exactly why the machine is still in Virginia, and that is exactly why the disassembly of the machine in Illinois, its transfer to Virginia, its reassembly, it worked dramatically differently after reassembly. That is exactly why in the amendment that we negotiated over a period of over a year, we made sure that before any payment was due from us, that the machine had to pass the runoff test not only in Illinois but in Virginia, because we knew it would have to be disassembled, shipped, reassembled. We wanted to make sure it was going to work at our facility, which is the whole point of the contract. So you're exactly right. That difference existed, and it's exactly why we structured the amended agreement in the way that we did, to which REI agreed that it had to pass the runoff test in Virginia.
Why was it a key thing that the Virginia court worked faster? Here we are a lot farther down the pipe. It doesn't seem to have achieved anything.
Well, it's, Your Honor, it will achieve something once the case gets moving. It matters because it is one of the factors that the court considers under a Section 1404 transfer analysis. That's one of the five or six factors. To answer the court's earlier question, REI, in addition to making the motion to enjoin us here, REI filed a motion to stay our case in Virginia. So, and the district court in Virginia, knowing that this appeal was going on, instructed us, we're not going to do anything in this case. Let me know how your appeal turns out.
What's the does the Western District of Virginia have a rocket docket for civil cases similar to the Eastern District?
It's not nearly as rocket full as the Eastern District, but it is
which
quick.
Sets records. Right?
It does not set the records, but the Western District is I think in comparison to most other places around the country, it is a very very quick jurisdiction. Nothing will match the Eastern District for better or for worse for those of us that appear there frequently. So, Your Honor, if you have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Mr. Keeley, your time had expired, but I'll give you a minute to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't take the time to rebut the factual matters that were raised off the record, but I want to make it abundantly clear. It is not REI's position that the 1404 factors don't apply here. It's clearly they do. The question, though, is what is the standard? And the standard here is a raised standard than in an otherwise pure 1404 case. And, in fact, the Citigroup case said because the filing in the Second District showed a lack of concern for judicial economy, that's going to be considered, and that's why the standard isn't higher. I can only say that with respect to the 1404 analysis that the court made, if you read the decision, it is a pretty close call except for performance, and I think that's where it varies. And in our view, the presumption by the first to file and even the deference that's supposed to be made under a 1404 was not given, and therein lies the error, together with the fact that under the first to file analysis, the court didn't complete its analysis and actually did not make any finding that any of the traditional exceptions had existed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.